And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, hello there. Good afternoon. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Monday edition of It's Your Turn. Open talk to begin the program today. We will have guests later. We're going to be chatting later on about whether or not romance is dead in the digital age. You know, we have Valentine's Day coming up here very shortly. Here we are, February 3rd already. Yeah. Well, we'll be talking about that a little bit later on the program today with Karu Papritz. Is romance dead in the digital age? Does anybody write love letters anymore? Also on the program today, I'm looking forward to an interesting conversation for a few minutes with a man who was able surreptitiously to take photographs of a great many big stars, big rock stars during concerts quite a few years ago. His name is Julian David Stone. So how did he do this? Did he sneak cameras into concert venues or what? You know, because most of the big stars, they're very protective of their official photographs. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on the program today. But open talk to begin with. Our phone number is 283-2525. What a gorgeous day, huh? What a winter it has been. And I know there's still a lot of winter left, and a lot of folks are wondering, are we really going to get hammered here later in February or in March? I don't know. But my goodness gracious, it's been the mildest winter that I can ever remember in my lifetime. I haven't seen any statistics yet as to the month of January, you know, whether or not it's the warmest one on record. It's got to be one of the top ones. I mean, my goodness. And would you believe we went until February 2nd, the Groundhog Day, before many folks in our listening area saw their first significant snow? We had 2 to 3 inches yesterday across the region. But even that was strange. Because if you got up yesterday morning, even after daybreak, you know, if you slept in a little bit, it was snowing. It was snowing to beat the band. Up until around, 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, suddenly the snow stopped. And 2-3 inches of snow was gone by afternoon when the temperature's climbing, and right now we're in the mid-50s. Mid-50s. Unbelievable. Okay, let's get to the telephones here. After all, it's open talk on this segment of It's Your Turn today, so let's see what the people have to say. Hi there. Caller, this is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Hi.
Hey, I didn't know if you knew what today is in the music history.
Today is the day the music died, right?
It is.
Yeah, tell our listeners about that for folks who don't know what we're talking about here.
Yeah, we got a plane, 1959, February 3rd, took off with, who was it, Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper, and the pilot, Roger Peterson.
I did not know the pilot's name. I knew the others.
Went right down up in Clear Lake, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Clear Lake, Iowa. I got a chance to visit that.
Oh, really?
Yes, wow. Yes. 2 years ago, I was on my way out to Sturgis on a motorcycle and found myself going up to Clear Lake, Iowa just to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Surf ballroom and the crash site was about 10 miles out in the middle of nowhere.
Do they have historical marker or something there, or did you just know where it took place?
Well, boy, these phones are something. I just talked in my phone, hey, take me to the crash site of Buddy Holly. And it took me, you know, it was back a gravel road, and you you kind of do have to know. There's no big marker. They do have a pair of Buddy Holly glasses at the edge of a farm field. And I was lucky enough to be there. I was there, like, I slept at a truck stop and got up early in the morning. I was probably there when the sun was coming up about 6 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to walk back a field. I bet it's about a half mile. It's a half mile. I was ready to give up, but then I kept going, and then I saw the sun glisten off some, you know, something, and I knew it was back there. So you go back there, and there they have, each of them has like a gold record, some crosses, and, you know, people leave stuff, but it's very moving.
Mm. They were, for people who are too young or too old to know, to know what you're mm-hmm. talking about,
yeah.
All of those, all three of those were big stars. Richie Valens was probably the most amazing. He was 17 years old. I mean, my goodness, and he'd had two or three really big hits already.
He just, at that time, he had the number one song in the nation, and he had that La Bamba, and I think Donna.
Donna was another one, yeah.
Yeah, that was his girlfriend. She didn't get to see him before he left. Her father wouldn't let him let her see him, and he left there. He was all excited to go on this tour with Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly did not want to go on this tour, but he was... All his money was tied up with record labels. He had to go. He didn't have any money. His wife was pregnant, and so he had to go. And it was in the middle of February in the Northwest, and it was freezing cold. The bus kept breaking down, and that's what... And Buddy Holly, they had... the Crickets had left, and he was kind of solo. And he mm-hmm. put a band together. It was Waylon Jennings and Tommy Alsop was his band and a drummer. Not sure the drummer's name. But when they got to the Illinois or Clear Lake, that show was added at the last minute.
Huh.
And nobody had gotten a shower for 12 days. And he said, I'm going to charter a plane and go... get my band, take my band up to Fargo. They were going to Fargo. So he chartered a plane and, you know, for his band. And here the big bopper was sick. He was sick as a dog, and he just, he asked Waylon Jennings if he could have his seat on the plane. And Waylon Jennings said, yeah, if it's okay with Buddy. Yeah, I'll give it up to you. He was a nice guy. So he did that. And then Richie Valens was bugging Tommy Alsop for that last seat on the plane. And Alsop, they were getting ready to go to the plane, and he went back into the Surf ballroom. Richie Valens was signing autographs. He looked at him and said, hey, how about that seat on the plane? And Alsop grabbed a quarter and flipped it, said, call it, and he called heads, and he said, it's yours. So Buddy Holly was on a plane with without his band.
Wow. Buddy Holly was...
It was meant to be.
Buddy Holly was also very young. He wasn't as young as Richie Valens. He was 22.
He was 22.
Yeah. And one of the... really one of the lead... artists developing what became known as rock and roll. In fact, he was so influential to later acts, among them the Beatles. Did you know that the Beatles took their name partly from Buddy Holly and the Crickets? Did you know that?
I did hear something like that. Yeah, wanted the like an animal name or bug name. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And they originally spelled it Beetles, like Beatles. You know, crickets, Beatles, and then they changed it to BEA. But that's where they got the name. And of course, the big bopper, J.P. Richardson, he was famous for Chantilly Lace. That was by far his favorite tune.
Now, he and Buddy, both of their wives were pregnant when that happened.
Hmm.
Buddy Holly's wife had a miscarriage, and then Big Bopper, he had a son that actually tours and does his stuff. He looks just like him, you know, his son, but his son never knew him.
So how is it that you're obviously extremely knowledgeable on this? You a big fan of the music of that era?
Not real. I think, you know, I credit it to Don McLean's American Pie.
Yes. Yeah.
And he solely wrote that for Buddy Holly, dedicated that album to Buddy Holly. And, you know, you listen to that. And even I've seen McLean in concert a couple of times, and he talks about it. He loves that song. He'll play it twice at, you know, at shows. And he you know, made him millions of dollars. But he said, you know, those were the three biggest acts in the country to go get killed like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said his father died, and then 10 years later, he wrote that in like 69-70, and then he you know, just a powerful song, and it gets you talking. And then he says when that come out, you know, his song come out, and it just rejuvenated people. He says they'd play his song, and then they'd play Buddy Holly's song. And he said he was so thrilled that he was able to get that music back in circulation.
Well, that was a small private plane, by the way, for people who aren't familiar. This wasn't a, you know, a real commercial jetliner.
Yeah, it was a charter single-prop plane.
Yeah,
it was just a small went down in a field, and the bus that took the band members, nobody knew anything. They walked into the hotel, and they saw the Big Bopper and Buddy Holly's pictures on the TV, and they initially thought, oh, this is going to be a big concert. They're on TV. Hmm. And then the people getting their rooms, custodian said, oh, no, those guys died in a plane crash. Yep. So that's how they all found out. And they still had to perform that night.
Well, today was the day, February 3rd, 1959, the day the music died.
Yep.
Sad story, but a good one. And, the number of entertainers that have died in small plane crashes, Rick Nelson, same thing. Small private plane. Jim Croce.
Half a Leonard Skinner band. But I believe that one probably still touches people the way. I often think, what if it didn't crash? You know, what we would have and what we wouldn't have. I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah, we wouldn't have American Pie, and what Buddy would have went and done. He was modeling himself after Elvis. Once he saw Elvis, he was just in love with rock and roll, and that's what really got him going. I think he would have been a huge, huge guy.
I agree. Well, listen, thanks for the memories, and thanks for reminding us that today was the day, my friend. Good to talk with you today.
Hey, thanks for your time, Dave.
Sure. So long. The day the music died, February 3rd, 1959. Open talk on the program today, 283-2525 is the number. 283-2525, while the great American extravaganza has come and gone for another year, the Super Bowl. Did you watch last night? I did not watch the Super Bowl for the first time in my life. I mean, I've gone times where I didn't watch the whole thing. I was in and out, but I didn't watch it at all this year. And I don't know. I guess I'm just tired of the hype and the extravaganza and the hoopla and everything else. It just seems like it's, you know, we've done this before. We've talked about this before. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. 283-2525, open talk. Let's go to this line next. Hi there, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Good afternoon, Dave. How are you?
Just fine. Nice to talk with you today.
Thank you. I'm just calling to put a scam warning out to people.
Oh, great. Go ahead, please. Yeah.
I attended the farm show in Harrisburg.
Mm, yeah, the State Farm Show last month. Yeah. Mm.
Okay. And I don't know. I must have signed my name for something or other. But I got a call from a lady and it's called Sundance Vacations.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, telling me all about, they give you they'll send you on a vacation different places in U.S. or countries, and they pay up $800 to $1,200 for a resort stay. And if you go on a certain day, they also give you $100 for Uber. And that's if you go into, they want you to go to Monrovia Mall and talk to them there.
Mm.
So on a certain day or a certain time. And then they also will give you $300 for to go to a concert or a sporting event or something like that. So I was kind of interested in it. Me and my friend were going to go, and then my son, I was telling him, and so he looked it up on the internet, and Sundance Vacation is a scam. There was a lady that was called, I can't think of the guy's name, on KDKA that looks into that stuff. Is it Sheehan, or I can't think of his name.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a scam. She went, she signed papers, and she's saying that they keep on getting her into things and wanting her to go on more vacations, and she has to keep on paying money to them. And she has, it's been almost a year, she still hasn't been able to go on a vacation yet.
I've heard some of those offers, and, you know, sometimes when it seems too good to be true... That's kind of a pretty big red flag. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what I kind of thought. But I was a little, you know, just kind of wondering. Me and my friend were going to go, and well, we're still scheduled to go Tuesday, but I'm not going to. I'm just not going to show up.
Did they ask you for any more information whenever you got this phone call? Any more personal information?
No. They just, you know, wanted to know if you had someone that would go with you, and just told you about what I told you, you know, what all involved, and they scheduled a time and a day for you to go to Monrovia Mall. They told you where to park and where it was at, and that's basically it.
I always try to use common sense on these things. I mean, well, you really think they're going to be giving away hundreds of dollars
right.
worth of stuff? I mean, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was like $800 to $1,200 for the vacation, which, I mean, for a resort, I was looking, I mean, that's about, since where you go, you know, a lot of places cost more than that to stay at a resort. It was for, I don't know. I might have it backwards. It's either 7 days and 8 nights or 8 days and 7 nights or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, you kind of think there's got to be a hook in there somewhere, you know.
Right. I kind of thought that. But I thought, well, maybe we'll go down, but didn't want to just make sure I didn't sign anything. But, you know, they can be pretty persuasive.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, driving the whole way to Monroeville is, you know, that's going to cost you some time and some gasoline, you know?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, thanks for the alert for people
that... Yeah, I just wanted people to know if they went to the farm show
mm-hmm.
in Harrisburg, they signed for anything, they get a call like that, don't bite on it.
Yeah. You never know these days where that data is going, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Thanks
for the warning, my friend. Good to talk with you today.
Yes, Dave. You're welcome.
Sure. So long. There's another scam I just read about over the weekend. It's out, and this is a Social Security scam. Last couple of years, it's been the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service scams. Now, that's probably going to be surfacing again now that we're into the tax season, because by the end of January, which was just last Friday, you know, financial institutions are supposed to have all of your records mailed to you so that you can begin to put your income taxes together. And I'm sure that we'll be getting word of a scam here and a scam there. But Last year, the IRS scams died down a little bit. Now, the big ones they're worried about are Social Security scams, where people call. Well, the story that I read about concerned, and they invariably target older folks, the elderly. This story happened in early December, when a woman who was from Chicago, I believe. Anyway, she got a call. Caller caught her on a busy day and told her that her Social Security number had been compromised and that a car registered in her name was found with blood all over it at a crime scene near the U.S. border with Mexico. And the caller insisted that some family member was in danger, but that she could keep her and her money safe if she just emptied any accounts tied to her Social Security number and sent the cash to a secure haven in Hong Kong. As soon as you see that, as soon as you hear that, you have to think that this is crazy. You know, how many times do we have to tell people never, ever, ever give out personal information, bank numbers, Social Security numbers to an unsolicited caller? It's just not wise in this day and age. Let's take another call. Open Talk at 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Dave, I just had to call when you mentioned about the Social Security fund.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Because, I am elderly, you know, 88, and I got a call just 2 weeks ago.
Oh, my.
And told me that my Social Security number was compromised. It had been used along the Texas border.
Hmm.
And I just hung up.
So this is the same scheme that I was just talking about with this woman. That's just amazing.
Well, so I was listening when I heard you say that. I thought, oh my God, I just got that call. I am leery of anybody who calls me, and I just don't talk to them.
That's the way to do it. Don't get into any conversation. They're prepared
no,
to. They have a response to everything you can say. Just hang up. That's what you got to do.
That's exactly. You may not remember, but I can't remember if it was last year or not. You were talking about something and said that you don't talk to these people. You just, you know, sometimes I think you said you didn't even answer the phone.
No, I don't.
Yeah, I just remembered you saying that. And I have a daughter who happens to be an attorney, and she cautions me all the time about scams that are played. Mom, don't ever take anything seriously. I was so bothered that day because I'd never gotten a call like that about my Social Security. So I called the local Social Security office, and the agent who, that's the way the call began to me. They said she was agent so-and-so, gave me a name and told me that if I called this number I was to call, I would speak to another agent name and gave me a name, you know, kind of thing. Of course,
they make it sound very official, don't they?
Yeah, you know, kind of thing. Anyway, I called the local Social Security office, and when the agent answered my call and I told him what happened, he said, ma'am, we never call you. If there's a problem, they will write to you,
but they will never
ever call you. And when I called my daughter then and told her my experience, she said, Mom, always remember that neither the IRS nor Social Security will ever call you about anything.
I'm hearing you. Hey, listen, thanks for letting us know about that and backing up my story here.
I just wanted to know that it might be coming up locally for some people, and they should pay attention, Dave.
Unbelievable. Thanks, my friend.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
So long. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Let's go to this line next. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi, Dave.
Yes, hello.
How you doing?
Hello.
Dave, this is your guest on your next part of your program, Carew Paprick.
Terrific. Hey, nice to talk with you, Carew. I've been telling the folks that we were going to be chatting with you coming up on the program today. So let me just let folks know that you're listening to WISR 680 in Butler. I'm Dave Malarkey, the It's Your Turn program, and Carew Paprick is talking to us. The discussion is going to center on, as I told you earlier on the program today, love letters. Is romance dead in the digital age? Is anybody still writing love letters? So what's the deal on this, Carew? Are love letters out the window? Nobody's doing it anymore?
I don't think so, but I'm a romantic, so I'm the worst person to ask. But I don't think it's that. Not at all. I don't think romance is dead so much as the romancing it. Mm-hmm. And romancing definitely comes with writing a love letter.
There's something special about it. And by the way, when we're talking about this, we're talking about a handwritten letter that's actually sent through the mail. We're not talking about an email that goes from your phone to somebody's computer, somebody else's phone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Dave, I got to tell you, there's a funny story. The other day, I was talking to the elementary school. There's a bunch of sixth graders, and this is my son's school. And I was telling them about, I'm an author, and I have a book out called The Legacy Letters, again, letters. And so I was telling the kids about it, and I said, hey, Valentine's Day is coming up. I'm going to tell you about the importance of letters. So I said to the girls in the class, I said, how many of you would rather receive a letter than a text? And all the girls in that class, their hands shot up in the air. And I told the boys, I said, take a look at that, guys. I mean, does that tell you something? So we went on for about 5 or 10 more minutes, wrapped up the class, and then I says, anybody have any questions? And this guy in the back shot his hand up. He says, Mr. Paprick, he says, when are you going to start teaching us how to write a love letter? And I said, there it was. Look at that. I mean, he caught on right away.
So what's the appeal? Is it because, I can tell you what I might think, is it because you actually see the handwriting of someone who sends you a letter like this as opposed to just impersonal typing?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And so I sort of say, why write a letter, let alone a love letter, in the first place? And the key element is that a letter takes time. And it's your time that you're putting into the letter. And if we think of time as the most valuable gift that we have in our lives, then we are literally giving this gift of time inside this letter. And, you know, real romance takes time. So if we're just, you know, I like to say that, you know, nowadays foreplay has been reduced to 5 text and a heart-shaped emoji. That's how quick things are. But I think what's really interesting is that once you write this letter with your hand and it's handwritten, people understand that it took time and effort to get that. A text or an email, you could bat that out right away. So it's, again, it comes down to that instantaneousness in our society that's everywhere. But this really shows that you put work into it.
The worst of all, in my opinion, Carew, is these already written greetings. Have you got one of these? Which is somebody has sent you an electronic greeting card, and
if
you open it up, and it's done, they didn't even make the effort to, you know, buy a card.
Isn't that funny? It really is. It comes down to that. Here, I was just thinking about you, boo, I got it done. I mean, there's almost the feeling that, I got it over with, and it'll make you laugh for a moment, and that's it.
Yeah.
But when we think about letters, I mean, letters are real, and they're human-sized, and they're made for your hands to hold. I think that's it. And because they're real, they're physical, as opposed to an email or a text. And in holding them, you can literally hold that person's time in your hands. I mean, that's how I want people to sort of look at why letters are still important and why they, and of course, the fact that, you know, who's going to save their love texts or their love emails? Some people will, but when you hold a letter and it's in that handwriting and you can recognize that person's letter, I mean, how powerful is that?
Yeah. And I have saved occasionally a note or a card that you get from somebody over the years. And, you know, every once in a while you dig out your souvenir box and you see that. Nobody's going to do that with a text message or an email.
No.
Are they?
No. No, not at all. Not in the least. And that's, I think that's why, and it's really interesting when, again, generationally, when you show something like, oh, this was from my great-grandmother. She wrote my great-granddad in the big war, you know, and oh, look at that. That's amazing. And people are shocked at how powerful that is. And that's right. Letters are still powerful, but it takes time, and you have to make the time to do it. And that's the key part.
Listen, I need to take a quick break, but I want to talk about your book. Can you stick with us through the break here? Okay. You're listening to the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. A quick break. We'll be back to talk more about the importance of letter writing with Karu Papridge here on It's Your Turn on WISR. We will be right back. Hey, here's a good way to beat the winter blahs. Get out of town for a few days. Why not take a trip with Butler Motor Tours? Butler Motor Tours, a local company. They're on South Monroe Street in Butler. They've been around for more than 75 years. And when you travel with Butler Motor Tours, you travel in comfort on one of their big motor coaches, their big cruisers. By the way, they always take trips down to Florida, too, in the winter months. So there's an idea to look at. If you want to check out their offerings, just go to their website. It's butlerbus.com. Butlerbus.com. All their upcoming trips are listed there with the dates and the itinerary and the cost and all of that. You can even book online if you so desire. And you can get gift certificates, too. Butler Motor Tours. Check them out online at butlerbus.com. That's Butler Motor Tours online at butlerbus.com. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary, and the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Welcome back, friends. Monday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. We're chatting with Karu Papritz, our guest on this segment of the program. He joins us by telephone today. From where? You're down in the Southwest, aren't you, Karu?
We are down in the South, the cold Southwest, just south of Tucson,
wow.
Arizona.
Well, get this, folks. During the break, I was chatting with Karu, and he said, I think you're pretty close to Elwood City, PA, aren't you? I said, yes. And then you said, Karu, what, your wife has family there or something?
Yeah, I think she's still got some family there on her father's side. So last name is Kildew. So if any of you know a Kildew out there, that's my connection to Elwood City at the moment.
Small world. It's just amazing sometimes. Wow. Well, listen, the picture that I see of you have a cowboy hat on. You're known as the cowboy philosopher. Where did that nickname come from, Karu?
Well, actually, it's a funny nickname that's been put on because I think a lot of cowboys are philosophers, but I actually worked as a working cowboy for a number of years at a ranch south of here, and it was a pretty lonely place, but it was a great place to sort of figure out the universe and ride horses and write books.
Well, you mentioned one of your books is The Legacy Letters. It's a multi-award winning book. Tell our listeners what it's all about.
Yeah, The Legacy, well, it's a series of letters. It's a fictional series of letters written by a father who had never lived to see his kids, and these letters become their practical, moral, and spiritual guidebook for the rest of their lives. And fascinatingly enough, it's the first book in publishing history to win awards in both fiction and nonfiction. And I think the nonfiction part is because of the way that people use the letters in their life, because there's so many different aspects about talking about love and work and writing, and it's full of it. So it's I'm very pleased to that won the awards, but even more so the response from people. It's been extraordinary.
Speaking of response, are the letters, is it back and forth between two parties? You know, get a letter, send a letter back, or?
No, they're actually, there's sort of a backstory to it in that this father, he the letters were written many, many, many years ago. And he separates from his wife under tragic circumstances, never gets to see the kids. And so the letters are all written. He's up in a mountain cabin. This is where he's going to die. And the letters are actually left behind and discovered and then brought to the kids on their 10th birthday. And that's sort of where the book starts.
Oh, wow.
So, no, they're actually written to the children starting on their 10th birthday, but they're written to their entire lives. So it starts off somewhat simply, but he realizes as he's writing that he needs to write to them about all the important aspects of life. So it becomes becomes a bit of an emotional and spiritual journey for him, while at the same time he's passing on these, you know, how do you change the oil on a car and why is that important? So all these, it's really a neat book.
Sometimes it's just those ordinary, run-of-the-mill, you know, daily life things that you had come across years later that someone had written about that really touch your heart, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. And sort of coming back, Dave, to what we were talking about, writing the perfect love letter. And one of the things I talk about in writing a letter is we think we have to be really good writers. And we have to, you know, write the perfect prose. And it's got to be so romantic. And one of the things that I say is, hey, all you have to do is write three things about the most everyday actions that someone does for you, you know, whether it be cooking you breakfast or changing the oil on your car. You know, I love the way you do this, and I love the way you do this. I love the way you put the kids to bed at night and read them a book. I mean, I think therein lies the simplicity and beauty of just what you said. I mean, that's the, those are the things that are remembered long after all the other stuff's gone away.
I saw a story this past holiday season, Carew, about people who no longer send Christmas cards. I still do. I don't know whether I'm just old school or what. I don't send as many as I used to, but and I don't write letters in the Christmas card. Heaven forbid I don't write those, you know,
right,
mimeographed letters. It's the same to everybody. But I try to at least put a sentence in there, you know?
Yeah, I do the same. I almost have to do the same because of where I stand on letters in the world. But I'm always amazed that you better write Christmas, and you better write a love letter, better write a Valentine's letter to your wife, absolutely. Hey, and I'll tell you why I think letters are so important is because we just, I got to tell you, this is really wild. We, at this, our little community here, we just did the world's largest thank you letter, envelope, and stamp. And it was a handwritten thank you letter that the kids wrote to their teachers and parents, thanking them for what they did. It's the size of a high school gym.
Wow. Wow.
And the envelope and stamp. So we did that 2 years ago, and then we created the envelope and stamp, and we sent it. And we're doing this. I created this thing called National Thank You Letter Day on November 14th. So if you go to nationalthankyouletterday.com, you can check that out. But what was neat is our local post office donated 600 little postcards, prepaid postcards, for kids to send to their parents or whoever they wanted to thank. And we actually got a letter from our son, and I was just looking for it. I can't seem to find it right now, but he thanked us for, oh, I know where it's at. I'll pull it as an article that we just had. And he said, hold on 1 second. He said, "Dear Mom and Dad, thank you for all the wonderful times I've had with you. I love you, and I'm so glad I was born into this family. P.S. I would write more, but I can't. This postcard is very limited." He put love. Dave, I was shocked, and I was shocked at how powerful this little letter was. This little, and it just reaffirmed my belief that letters are powerful, and I'm going to hold on to this card until the day I die.
And with Valentine's Day just around the corner, you know, you don't necessarily have to mail it if it's, you know, your sweetheart, your partner. Just write a little note and leave it where she or he might find it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I tell people the other thing is it's the scariness. You know, you say, I got to write a love letter. I'm telling you, it's so, so easy. It's 5 minutes of your time. And so what I tell people is that everyone's got a printer, or most everyone, so you can go grab a sheet of paper and then write. I mean, got to find a pen, pen and paper, and you got to write something like, dear, honey, or darling, please don't use hay. Guess what hay is for? Hay is for horses, okay, right? And then you write these three things that your partner does for you every day that you're thankful for. And it's that simple. And you end it with love or however you want to do it. If you can find an envelope, I know it sounds old-fashioned, but give it a nice special, you know, even if you fold it over and say it to my sweet wife or to whoever, and then you give it to the person. And if you can send it by mail, I mean, so much the better, because what a great surprise that will be, because no one receives letters anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think the very act of handwriting that, 5 minutes, and my gosh, the amount of points you get in the universe. It's huge.
I hear you. I love it. Yeah, listen, our time begins to run short. I'm very intrigued by your book, The Legacy Letters. Is that available online, or where can we find it, Karu?
Absolutely. You can get copies through me check out the website, thelegacyletters.com, or, of course, our wonderful Amazon. Check it out there, or you can go to your local bookstore and ask if they have it in there. I really am a big supporter of local bookstores.
And so, if you're looking for Karu online, Karu, C-A-R-E-W, and his last name is P-A-P-R-I-T-Z. Just like it sounds, Karu Papritz. Hey, what a great conversation. I'm happy to chat with you for a few minutes here today, Karu.
Yeah, Dave, I appreciate that. I'm going to leave you with one last maxim for your audience is, just remember, the worst love letter in the world is no love letter at all.
Oh, that's no wonder they call you the cowboy philosopher.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Karu. Thanks so long.
All right, take care.
Nice guy, huh? Yeah. Well, we thought we'd give you a little tip there with Valentine's Day just around the corner. Yeah. Hey, more to come. Our final guest here on the It's Your Turn program on this Monday is Julian David Stone. And we have to take a quick break here, and we'll be back to chat with him right after these words.
Well, despite the old groundhog's prediction, we still may see some winter. The folks at West End Tire and Service are ready to go. They've got over 400 snow tires in stock for your car, light-duty truck. In fact, they've got tires for just about anything. You know where they are down there on West Cunningham Street. Used to be Siemens Tire Service. Well, they still have the same great people and the same great service that they always had. They can do brakes, shocks, struts, oil changes. They'll align your front end, rotate your tires, and fix your tires. And their talented technicians are there all the time to check your air pressure and do evaluations for free anytime you stop in. It's West End Tire and Service, West Cunningham Street, right next to Battery Warehouse Plus.
Plan ahead. We've all learned from experience that living day to day can lead to too many last minute surprises. Surprises that are often difficult and frustrating to handle. And so it is with a funeral. Planning a proper funeral takes pre-planning so that during periods of grieving and turmoil, you'll want those arrangements to already be taken care of. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler has been pre-planning funerals for more than 90 years, and the third generation of the same family is here to help you with that planning process now. Make these choices now. The funeral service, the choice of caskets, which minister, priest, or rabbi, cremation, visitations, flowers, church service or not, all these decisions can be made now before your emotions get in the way of logical and practical decisions. Pre-plan now with Thompson Miller. Think about it, and then call us and meet with us to discuss it privately. Call 724-287-3706. 287-3706. Pre-arrangements. It really makes sense. Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, because we care.
Coming up, listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest joins us by telephone. He is Julian David Stone. We're talking with him from sunny and warmer Southern California. And we want to talk about his new book, No Cameras Allowed. First of all, Julian Stone, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us here today.
Great to be on. Great to be chatting with you.
So tell us, No Cameras Allowed. That's an intriguing title. Tell us what your book's about.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think the full title will give you a little more. It's No Cameras Allowed, my career as an outlaw rock and roll photographer. And as the title states, it tells the story of a period in the early 1980s where, starting as a teenager, I used to smuggle my film equipment, photo equipment, into rock and roll concerts and photograph the shows. And over a period of about 4 or 5 years, I built up an archive of 10,000 pictures of all of the biggest stars of the 1980s, and all of it by sneaking my equipment in.
Wow. Could you have been arrested for that, Julian?
You know, I don't know if it's a question of being arrested as much as being thrown out of shows, which is part of my story. Going through this whole process, I had to evade security and bouncers to get in, and a few times I had some very funny run-ins with security at a Duran Duran show or Joan Jett. I had some great times, and that's part of what the book is. It's not just the photos. It also tells all the stories I had about why I started to do it, and everything in between about, you know, getting chased around and how I eventually went pro.
So you got some pretty good pictures in your book?
I do. I do. I've got Bowie and Prince and U2, the Talking Heads, all kinds of great photos that have never been seen before of some of the biggest stars in the period, all at the beginnings of their careers in many cases.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm guessing that the reason that they don't want people taking unauthorized photos, they have their own photographers who do this, and they don't want anybody, you know, horning in on their official photographs?
Well, it was interesting. It was just kind of the rule. In the early 1980s, it was just the standard rule that they didn't want you to take pictures. You know, I wasn't selling the photos. It was just, I was a teenager. I loved rock and roll, and it started at a Ramones concert where I thought, oh, here come the Ramones. They're coming to town. I love photography. This will be a great way to put the two things together. And I showed up at the club with a camera bag over my shoulder, and the bouncer just sort of laughed at me and said, you're not coming in here with that equipment. And I was about to dump it back in my car, and I suddenly thought, you know, there's got to be a way around this. And I hid it very quickly on my some of it down in my my socks and other places. And I got into the show and I photographed the Ramones. And after that, I was just hooked. And like I said, over the next 4 or 5 years, I took 10,000 pictures of all the big stars. It was almost, in a way, it was my way of being part of the rebellion that's at the center of rock and roll. You know, it was my way of being against the rules. But like I said, I wasn't selling the pictures. I just loved the bands, and it was my way of connecting to it.
So can you tell us, how did you get cameras in? Did you wear a big, heavy coat or something like that and have your equipment hidden under your coat?
Like I said, at the first show, it was done very quickly, and I stuck, you know, I used my socks. You know, this was the 1980s, and people had really big tube socks, and I stuck a camera body in one and a lens in the other. You know, this is way before digital. We're talking about 35-millimeter photo equipment. And then as I got more into it and more sophisticated and wanted to bring in more equipment, I got an old Navy pea coat that hung down almost to my ankles, and I modified it so that I could hide equipment inside the lining of it, so that when I would come into the show, they'd sort of give me a pat down and search, and they wouldn't find my equipment, which was often hanging way down at the bottom of the coat in the lining. So that was one of the ways I did it. And you learned other techniques. My socks were a big help for hiding rolls of film also as time went forward. That was pretty much it.
Did you have to try to disguise the fact that you were taking photographs? I mean, could you do this in plain sight of security people, or did you have to kind of sneak them?
Oh, you definitely had to sneak them. Like, once you got past security, that was the sort of the first step. Then during the show, you had to keep your equipment hidden, and I would just pop up, take a picture, and hide it away. But you weren't always safe. One time I was shooting, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, I was shooting Joan Jett, excuse me, in a really packed club, and I was in the center of the crowd, and I'm shooting away, and she's playing, and she's just amazing, and all of a sudden, I see this roadie come out on stage, and he's looking at me in the crowd, and he sees me with my camera, and he starts pointing at me, and I kind of look back at him. Well, what are you going to do? I'm in the middle of this packed crowd. I'm safe. Well, I found out real quick what he was going to do. He jumped off the stage and came tearing through the crowd at me, and he comes barreling down, and this was a big guy. But fortunately for me, just as he got to me, he kind of lost me in the movement of the crowd, and he took down the guy next to me. And so I just sort of slipped away like, oh, nothing to see here. So you definitely, during the whole experience, had to always be aware of the people around you.
Did you use telephoto lenses? I'm assuming you weren't shooting these shots from the first or second row. You must have been further back in the crowd, right?
Well, I had a little of everything. I mean, sometimes I did get that close. You know, as the show went on and I sort of felt safer, or that I'd gotten enough pictures and they were sort of, the completed rolls of film were hidden away on my body, I would get more adventurous. And sometimes I did end up in the front row, but I did also have bring telephoto lenses. In fact, I had a crazy story. When Prince came to town, I was so excited to see Prince. This was him sort of at the peak of his career. He had the Purple Rain movie out. He had the number one album, the Purple Rain soundtrack, and I bought a brand new telephoto lens, a huge lens, and it came the night before the concert. So I went down to the concert, and I was getting ready to go in, and I'd gone with a female friend. Well, the lens was just too darn big to hide anywhere on my body. It didn't fit in any of my normal hiding places. So I got this great idea. This was the 80s, and women used to carry around these huge cans of Aquanet. So we stuck the lens in my friend's purse, put the can of Aquanet on top of it, and headed into the concert. And we were approaching the security guard, and I remember him kind of looking at us, seeing us approach with this purse with this huge cylinder in it. And he was like, "What is that?" He opened it up, saw the can of Aquanet, was like, "Oh, okay." And in we went, because, you know, women's hair was huge in the 80s, so that's why she had the can of Aquanet. So in we went to the show. There I was, about 10th row center, with this beautiful telephoto lens, and that's why some of my favorite pictures in the book are of Prince.
Mm, that's right. That was back in the big hair days for women, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep, that's what I said. She had this huge can of Aquanet, and the hair was gigantic. Yep.
Did you ever have, of course, this is in the 80s now, so no digital cameras, you had to use film. Did you ever have any of your film confiscated, Julian?
I did. A couple of times I had it, look in the back of the camera, ripped open and pulled out. I got caught at a Duran Duran concert by their group security, and I'd shot a couple of rolls of film and already hidden those away when they caught me, and they took me outside and they ripped my film out and took all the rolls away, all the unexposed rolls. They didn't catch the exposed rolls. That's why I have a couple of pictures of Duran Duran that made it into the book. So that did happen a couple of times.
Just like in the movies, huh? They grabbed your camera, ripped it open, and it tore out the film.
They literally did that to me. Yeah, they took me right outside of the Los Angeles Forum in early 1984 and did that to me. And then they kind of loosened up after that when they realized that I was just a kid. But they definitely took the film, though.
Was the L.A. Forum, was that the big venue prior to the construction of the Staples Center?
That was it. That was where the Lakers played, and I believe the Clippers also, before they built the Staples Center and everybody moved to downtown.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, Julie, we're talking with Julian David Stone, author of No Cameras Allowed, My Career as an Outlaw Rock and Roll Photographer. It must have been pretty expensive. You know, the tickets to these concerts, even back in the 80s, they weren't cheap. Must have spent a lot of money on tickets, huh?
Yeah, well, you know what? Because people have asked me that, they actually kind of were cheap. I mean, you know, I still have a lot of the ticket stubs, and I use them as sort of, you see pictures of them in the book, too, to sort of fill out. The book sort of tells the whole story of the era, and the ticket prices were pretty low. I mean, you know, some of the club shows were $5, and I think my ticket stub to see Prince is literally $12.50. So it, you know, I'm sure if you made it into modern dollars, you know, obviously it's more, but the price of concerts has not gone up. It's gone up ahead of inflation. I mean, you could do it pretty cheaply if you saved up your money. You know, that to me wasn't a big obstacle, and I don't remember spending a lot. Particularly the club shows, like I said, were just a few dollars.
So you saved most of your ticket stubs, huh?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I have quite a collection of them from back then. They used to be so beautiful. Now, you know, it's either on your phone or it's a paper ticket. It's kind of lost the charm. It was kind of a real, real beautiful art back then.
I wish I'd have saved some of my concert tickets from people that I've seen over the years, too. I never thought about doing that.
Yeah, I've lost a few. I wish I had them all, but the majority of them survived all these years later.
Were most of the concerts that you attended and took these pictures in Los Angeles, or did you go to other cities?
Well, I started in the San Francisco Bay Area, so there's quite a few there. Then there's some in Los Angeles, but then I even have some, I have some in Europe. I have some really great pictures of U2 that I took in Ireland right when they were starting out in 1983, and those are some of the really special ones in the book. And then probably the biggest show that I chronicled, I have the Police at Shea Stadium in New York City. And for fans of the Police, this was a huge gig for them because they sold out Shea Stadium. You know, this is where the Beatles played, and it was a big deal. In fact, something that I didn't realize until I started talking to more Police fans as the book came out, this was the show where after the show they decided to break up because they kind of looked at each other and said, well, where do we go from here? It doesn't get any bigger than this, selling out Shea Stadium. So those pictures turned out to be pretty special.
So you had pictures of U2 playing in Ireland, of course. That's their home turf. That's where they're all from.
Yep.
This is early U2. Was Bono still wearing sunglasses already back in those days?
No, he's not. In fact, I have pictures of them from 1983 in Ireland and then about 18 months later in San Francisco. And in none of them, he has glasses on. And I was showing these pictures when this project started to come together a couple of years ago to my wife. And she's a little younger than me, and she didn't recognize him because everybody thinks of him with those glasses.
Yeah.
And this is way before the glasses. This is the early 1980s.
What about Elvis Costello? I've come to appreciate his talents a great deal more over the past decade or so than I did originally. Very, very multi-talented guy.
Oh, terrific. Yeah, he's in the book, too. Wonderful show I saw in the San Francisco Bay Area. He was on the Punch the Clock tour, which some Elvis Costello fans are not a big fan of, but I have a great affinity for that album and that tour. It was a terrific show, and he was in his very sort of classic look with the suit, kind of a crooner look.
And he's got twins, I think, now, doesn't he?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so.
I did not know that, but time passes.
Yeah, yeah. Have any of these famous musicians, rock and roll people, have they ever seen any of your pictures?
Yeah, funny you should mention that. Yes, there has been, and it's been really gratifying. You know, part of this was this whole thing sort of ended for me in the mid to late 1980s, and I put all the pictures away for 30 to 35 years before the whole idea to do the book came around. So nobody had seen these photos. And then when it came out, a lot of it started circulating on the internet and social media. So somehow somebody showed the pictures to Terry Nunn of Berlin, if you remember the band Berlin. And she posted all about it on social media, which was great. And another person who got to see some of the pictures and who was also really good, very positive about it, was Dale Bozzio of the band Missing Persons.
Do you have many pictures in the book? How many are in there?
Well, the book has 250 never-before-seen pictures, and the book is almost 300 pages. And it's not only these photos, like I said, U2, Prince, Bowie, all the big stars, the Go-Go's. It's also the stories, some of which I've told, of being chased by roadies and bouncers and all of that mixed in with just other remembrances of the 80s. If you love 80s rock and roll, it just really tells the story of pretty much those years from like 1980 to 1990.
Did you ever have people in the audience who saw what you were doing point you out, you know, pointing at you? Look at him, he's taking pictures. Did that ever happen to you?
It would be more kind of a smile, and then often I remember people sort of like enjoying the gag of it and then like showing me the bottle of whiskey that they had snuck in, like, oh, you brought a camera, I got my whiskey bottle in. I had that experience a few times with people kind of like, hey, look what I did.
Kind of funny.
It was more that they kind of enjoyed that we were, you know, we were sort of bonding over our sneaking in stuff.
Yeah, kind of funny when you mentioned earlier in our conversation about hiding your equipment in your jacket and in your socks. Is I thought about, you know, some people, I wouldn't say I've ever done it, of course, but, you know, sneaking popcorn into the movie theater to avoid paying $10 for, you know, a thing of popcorn.
Right.
I've seen that happen. I've seen that happen.
Oh, absolutely.
Where is your book available, Julian?
You can get it at Amazon, of course, or if you want autographed copies, you can get them at juliandavidstone.com, and there's more about the book there. But that's a great place to get autographed copies, or, of course, Amazon. Always there.
My Career as an Outlaw Rock and Roll Photographer by Julian David Stone. Hey, nice to chat with you today, Julian. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to chat with you.
Sure. So long now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 1230 to 130, right here on WISR 680.
Like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love, I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, my hands are shaking and my knees are weak. I can't seem to stand on my own two feet. Who do you think of when you have such luck? I'm in love, I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, please don't ask me what's on my mind. I'm a little mixed up, gonna feel fine when I'm near the girl that I love best. My heart beats so it scares me to death when she touches my hand. Oh, what a chill I got. Her lips are like a volcano that's hot. I'm proud to say that she's my buttercup. I'm in love, I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. My tongue gets tied when I try to speak. My insides shake like a leaf on a tree. There's only one cure for this body of mine. That's